This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, there is an air of optimism about the COVID-19 virus and our battle with it. It appears we're moving slowly, but we're moving towards a full opening of society on October 22nd, according to today's news. Yesterday, there were 1,293 new COVID cases. There are 382 people being treated in hospital and 61 people in intensive care. Of course, at the moment, it is believed that from next Monday, live events other than sports events will be possibly allowed to open. There has been intense pressure, for example, from the entertainment industry, and it's understandable given the terrible time they've had. The openings will be contingent on people being fully vaccinated, except for the GAA, who are not prepared to ask people for proof of double vaccination or full vaccination. But that issue aside, we can say that Ireland has been exemplary in terms of getting the vaccine. Somewhere between 88 and 90% of people have had it. The schools are open again this week, and of course that is another pressure point in the system. And it's a pleasure to welcome to The Stand now Professor Paul Moynihan. He's Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University and an award winner in this field 2 or 3 years ago. Professor Moynihan, all the signs are, or many of the signs, are optimistic. And yet, I note, for example, in the north yesterday, they had pretty shocking figures. And per head of population, I think they're doing about as bad as anywhere in the world. But in this jurisdiction, we still have, as Dr. Tony Holohan, the chief medical officer, said yesterday, we still need to be cautious and we still need to keep our protocols in place. That is, masks, social distancing, hand washing and all of that. Where do you think we are in this long war with this virus?
I think, Eamon, we're in a good place by virtue of the vaccination program that has been rolled out. I think it's been a fantastic success. And that is really what is giving us this air of optimism as we look forward. The vaccines are doing absolutely what they were designed to do, and that's protecting us from illness. I think there's been a lot of discussion now recently in terms of, you know, breakthrough infections. I think that's really important to discuss because as we look forward and map out what it's going to look like in the coming months and maybe the next year or two, I think it's important to understand the vaccines, how they work, and the protection that they give us. Vaccines protect us very well from serious illness, hospitalizations. We see that in all our numbers, and I think that's why we probably were optimistic at this point in time. But there will be challenges. So we have these breakthrough infections in the cases where people who are vaccinated will become infected again over time. Most of us who have been vaccinated probably will be exposed to the virus, and most of us will probably end up being infected by it. We probably shouldn't be surprised with that, but these vaccines then protect us from becoming very seriously ill. So I think over time, and I think we're beginning to see this, where we're moving away from looking at the number of confirmed cases to more indicators that are representative of the likely burden on the health system. So, for example, in terms of, you mentioned hospitalizations,
yes,
ICU admissions. And I think based on those metrics, we still obviously have to be cautious and we have to be responsive, I think, if we see, you know, very significant changes and increases in those indicators. But I think certainly as time progresses now, we've probably move away from, you know, looking at the number of confirmed cases as a way in terms of informing what our future strategy should be. So I think we're in a good place, mostly because of the success of the vaccines and the vaccination program. And I think that gives us lots of reason to be hopeful.
Now, the Northern Ireland situation is interesting and not in a good way, really. They had 1,259 positive cases yesterday and 6 more deaths were reported. And the hospital system in the north is, according to their minister, under extreme pressure for the second day in a row and urged people only to visit if it was an emergency. Can we separate ourselves for the purposes of policy and for going forward from this point? Can we separate ourselves from what's happening in the north, given the amount of interaction there is between north and south, and not just in the border counties, but particularly in the border counties?
Yes, it's very difficult, Eamon, to be absolutely precise in terms of that difference. Certainly in terms of our death rates, in Northern Ireland have been higher than here, relative in terms of the level of infection. And it's very difficult to know exactly why that is the case. You know, I've heard some commentators indicating maybe our restrictions have been more strict. You know, there's been better compliance here. But it's generally very difficult to even if you look at, for example, in the UK, across the UK, Northern Ireland, their numbers are higher than across the UK. So it certainly seems to be a hotspot. But certainly we look at our own record here. It has been quite good. Now, not exemplary, but certainly in terms of, you know, cases translating into serious illness, hospitalizations and deaths, we've done well to Northern Ireland. We've done reasonably well. But I think we need to look at the long-term context here as well. I think for a long time, we focused more on the short term. If we look and project into the future where we're going with our vaccination program, it's important now to say that most of the adult population now have been vaccinated. Most of the adult population are now reasonably well protected against the devastating effects of the virus with respect to our health. So that will stay. There will be some groups over time where there will be waning immunity. It may be important in those susceptible groups to apply and to introduce, you know, a booster program. But by and large, the vaccines are working really, really well and protecting us and will stop most people from progressing from an infection into serious illness. But over time, this virus is not disappearing. I think it's going to end up, and most scientists are agreeing now, it's going to end up, it'll become endemic.
Yes.
It will circulate at a certain level. At certain points, probably at certain points in the year, especially in winter months, you will probably see increased levels of transmission because they tend to transmit at those times of year. But importantly, the direct protection we get for the vaccine is very, very important. But there will be more cases. And I think the reason why it's been impossible to eradicate this virus is because of these breakthrough cases. But again, from an immunology perspective, Eamon, it's really important to say these breakthrough cases should be expected based on what we know about the immune system. I think it may be valuable just to explain why that is the case, why these vaccines protect us really well against illness, hospitalization, but there may be some breakthrough infections. And the reason there is when you get a vaccine, your immune system recognizes the vaccine, a little bit of the virus, and it produces antibodies. And the antibodies protect you from getting infected.
Yes.
But those antibodies stay in your bloodstream for probably 4, 5, 6 months. And then they wane and then they reduce greatly in levels. And it has to happen, Eamon, because otherwise our blood would be absolutely full of antibodies against all the viruses and bacteria that we've been exposed to. But importantly, if you're now exposed to the virus, we've got, because we've been vaccinated, we've got these memory cells in our bone marrow that can then recognize the virus and start producing more of those antibodies.
Right.
And then those antibodies with other cells in your immune system called T cells will kill any cells that have been infected by the virus. So there will be periods of time after we've been vaccinated for maybe 4 or 5 months, and we've seen this in Israel, where our antibodies will wane in the bloodstream and the virus may be able to infect us. But for most people who are infected, being vaccinated, some won't even be aware of it, to be completely asymptomatic. Some will be mildly symptomatic. But because of this immunity that we have, that will protect us from getting very sick. So this is how normal immune system works. So we shouldn't be surprised. There's nothing unusual about this. And that is how these vaccines protect us. And that is the protective wall that we have. In some cases, especially maybe people as we get older, as we all age, our immune system is not quite as robust. So that recall, that when the antibodies wane and these memory cells are called upon, as we age, we don't produce as many of those memory cells. It may not be as robust or as prolonged. So in those cases, we may have to give a booster. But again, we can be very smart about that, because there are very, you know, really good tests to check if somebody's antibodies levels are low or high, maybe if they need a booster. So I think we can be, you know, very informed in terms of the approach and the strategy that we take. But the vaccines, again, like none of the variants, we hear a lot about the Delta variant, but there are no variants so far that can completely evade the protective response that is given to us by the vaccine.
Now, the reopening of schools this week, for many families, this is an important moment, particularly given how difficult education has been for children in the last, over the last 18 months. Their children are back in school now. And that is a development that we cannot be really sure of. Or do you think we can?
No, there is some uncertainty there. So some of the things that we haven't experienced before, we haven't experience the Delta variant during winter months.
Yes.
And that is something, even as we model and NPHET has modeled and they've said that it's likely that the current wave will peak in September and then go to its lowest maybe in December time. I think of some reasons why that could be the case in terms of vaccination, and our vaccination becomes even more comprehensive. But I can think of other reasons why that might not be the case. For example, in the winter months, these respiratory viruses transmit better. I've just mentioned there in terms of these breakthrough infections, that the further we move, each of us as an individual, the further we move from our last vaccine, the more likely that we will see these breakthrough infections. So there's no guarantee there, and there is some air of unpredictability in terms of what those cases are. And I wouldn't be surprised to see numbers going up in the winter months, especially in schools. But thankfully, if there is one positive thing from this pandemic, it's that children have been largely spared from, you know, the really damaging effects of the virus. But that's not to say that we can be complacent, that and that as we move, you know, to open up schools, which in my view is really, really important. I think children have suffered quite a lot. So I think it's really important that schools are opened. But that doesn't get away from the fact that we should still be as proactive as possible in terms of suppressing transmission within that environment. And certainly, I've looked at some of the guidelines that schools and primary schools especially have received over the last number of weeks in terms of opening. And some of the details there, Eamon, has surprised me a little bit in terms of that. I don't think we've moved on quite as much as we should with respect to following the science. So a lot of those guidelines are still focused quite heavily in terms of the importance of hygiene and hand hygiene. And hand hygiene, I don't want to... That is really important, not only for COVID, but for all types of infections. Really good hygiene and hand hygiene practice. But we now know that the risk of getting this virus from a contaminated surface, you know, is quite low, certainly low relative to, because the fact that it is airborne.
Yes.
So in terms of looking at airborne and being more proactive about that, I probably would have liked to have seen, again, more focus with respect to air quality, air hygiene. There are some welcome initiatives there, for example, in terms of, you know, supplying schools with carbon dioxide monitors. That gives us an idea in terms of when ventilation may be more required. But in some schools, especially older schools, ventilation may be a problem. It may be difficult to get efficient ventilation. And I think in those cases, you need, for example, portable air filtration systems, HEPA-filtered systems, which are available. And yet, in those guidelines, there's been no focus no emphasis with respect to, you know, using, embracing this technology. And even with respect to some of the supplementary budgets that have been given to schools, especially around cleaning, in my view, have been much more effective to use some of that supplementary budgets to build in, you know, better capacity with respect to increasing air filtration. And then the other thing that's disappointed me somewhat, and, you know, the last number of months, and maybe a number of months ago, it was discussed in detail, the role of antigen testing. And, you know, a lot of pilots, we've heard a lot of pilots have been done, not only in schools, but also in the third level sector. And again, it's been disappointing in those guidelines, the silence there with respect to, will a rapid antigen test be used in schools? In what context, under what circumstances will they be employed? So again, I was a little bit disappointed to see us not using and embracing technology. And again, I think it's sort of a signature of some of the ways we've responded throughout the pandemic, where we've put everything in terms of, you know, our own human behavior, in terms of restrictions, where at times I think maybe we could have supplemented that better, and maybe some of the restrictions may not have had to be as harsh if we were maybe to embrace more the technology. The rapid antigen testing is one, you know, air filtration systems now is another. So I would probably like to see more technology being used and employed to its maximum potential.
And I suppose any parent should ask these questions of a school, and that's a reasonable question to ask, is it not?
I think it's very fair, Eamon. And the reason why I say this in terms of constantly schools, just so happens I'm involved in board of management on a local primary school. So I'm sort of aware of the challenges that face not only the school, but also the staff, and also the concerns and worries of parents, as you mentioned. But again, schools, they've been left, for example, with the air filtration system, they've been sort of left to their own devices there.
Yes.
And with the best will in the world, you know, boards of management, teachers, we're not equipped really to go out and to research this. So I think a little bit more support, assistance. And again, even in terms of how some of the supplemental budgets that have been very useful and valuable for schools, but how do you use them optimally? I don't think they're being used optimally at the moment. And maybe a little bit more flexibility in that regard, I think, would be useful.
Dr. Tony Holland, the Chief Medical Officer, appears to have set his face against antigen testing throughout this.
Yeah, and I still don't know why. I mean, there's lots of studies coming out now showing, I think part of the focus has been in terms of, would it be useful with respect to being able to pick up cases of infection that are asymptomatic? And I think that's been completely the wrong focus.
Right.
These rapid antigen tests, they basically pick up, you've got a high viral load, and a high viral load is when you're infectious. So these tests are really good at detecting when you're infectious, when you've got a level of virus, which means you're highly likely to transmit that virus onto another person.
Yeah, and sorry to interrupt you, Paul. Children have not been seriously ill with this virus, but they can transmit it, and that's a real problem, is it not?
They can transmit it. Thankfully, it appears that children maybe under the age of 12 that still transmit it, but they're probably transmitted not to the same extent as older children
right.
and adults. And we don't really know why that's the case. Maybe it's just due to the lower lung volume. We're not quite sure in terms of why that is the case, but certainly it seems to be the case. But that's not to say, we can't say that children do transmit the virus. That's the reality, but maybe not to the same extent. So with respect to rapid antigen testing, you know, and developed in such a way in terms of self-testing, where, you know, some other countries, there's situations where if somebody's a close contact, you know, rather than excluding them from school, they would do a rapid antigen test there each morning. So basically, it's about a minute to do it, Eamon. You leave 15 minutes before the child has his or her breakfast or before brushed her teeth. Just do this, and then 15 minutes later, comes back. If it's positive, you stay at home.
Right.
If it's negative, you go in. Now, there is this sense in terms of that it would encourage people to behave differently and that they would sort of behave with abandon then. I never supported that contention, because I think the people who wanted to use antigen testing, they wanted to use them to make more informed decisions around their behavior. And I think the people who are going to use them, if they saw a positive test, they were going to obviously not go to whatever event they were going to go to. If it was negative, I don't think they're going to behave any differently. It would give them a little bit more confidence in terms of attending the event or whatever. But again, I would, and even with respect to not only schools, but there's been a lot of discussion over the last 2 weeks in terms of, for example, the live events industry. Yes. And, you know, the opening up of that. And I just, again, can't understand why, you know, we hear lots of pilot events, trial events. There were some of them done in the summer, but they were designed in such a way where basically all risk was essentially removed from the events and didn't mirror in any way what an event would sort of look like, you know, realistically. So again, I thought during the summer, I think there were just so many missed opportunities during the summer for doing some of these events, but also doing pilot events for indoor events where they would represent, you know, more closely what a real event would look like. And maybe, you know, in situations where there'd be no masking, no social distancing, and then look in those pilot events at the measures you would put in place to mitigate the associated risks. And that was the time, I think, to do those pilot events. So I think we just missed an opportunity. And what we've done is we've back-ended everything up to later parts of the year, into the autumn months, into the winter months, at a time when viral transmission tends to be higher. When, as we move, most of us move from maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 months post our second vaccine, where breakthrough infections will become more common. Just from a logistical point of view, it never quite made sense to me why we back end all of this towards the back end of the year and not use that part of the year, which to a degree the UK used. You know, there was this freedom day that I don't necessarily subscribe to, one day and everything disappears. But one of the reasons why they tended to do that during the summer was that schools were closed during the summer months. Viruses tend to transmit less well. And so this was probably a good time. And even though, you know, there were various predictions of, you know, Armageddon, and it was suggested it was reckless, and a lot of the modelling, it just didn't transpire, Eamon, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just think there was a lost opportunity there in the summer. And as we begin to open up now again, which generally I'm in favour of, but I think some of this could have been done during the summer at lower risk, whereas we're now moving into a situation where a lot of the restrictions will be lifted, will be removed. But we're doing it at a time when, you know, viruses tend to transmit better at the times that most of these restrictions will be removed.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
If we widen the lens a little bit, Professor Moyna, and look at the EU, they have now put the US on a red list and travel restrictions are going to be enforced. If we look at the United States, there are 90 million people, roughly 30% of the population, who are vaccine resistant. And in some notorious cases, Texas and Florida come to mind. The governor of Texas, Abbott, already contracted the disease. In Florida, the governor is against mask wearing, and it's the whole question of this fight against the virus has been politicized. In the House of Commons last week, at the special debate on Afghanistan, when the House was packed, without exception, all the Tories were maskless. Without exception, the people on the Labour side wore masks. This kind of thing, but I want to stick with the American thing for a moment because it's an example of politicization at its worst. If 30% of the population of the United States refused to take the vaccine, are we wise to follow the EU lead put travel restrictions in place? How much damage can the Americans do and any other large nation that refuses to put in place the kind of measures that we have seen succeed here?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of aspects to that, Eamon. And so certainly, yes, there is risk. So in populations, some of that is by choice. As you mentioned, the US, and I think one of the success stories here is, as you know, and we can agree to disagree and argue in terms of, you know, restrictions and how strict they were, how prolonged they were here. But the one thing, there was general sort of solidarity in terms of how we approached this from our perspective, which I think has helped us enormously. So I think when the restrictions came in and public health advice and they were imposed or whatever, there was really good compliance. And the US is very heterogeneous, you know, from state to state. Yes. And I think, again, that hasn't helped. So you can't really look upon the US sort of as a single entity. And not only has it been heterogeneous, but in some cases it's been quite polarizing. So widening that out, yes, there is risk, but not only in terms of from the US, where from choice in terms of some states and in terms of the policy of individual states, it's led us to situations where maybe the uptake of vaccines is not what you would like to see, but also more broadly, other countries, for example, sub-Saharan Africa, where the availability of vaccines is still at a very low rate. And I think that's where really a lot of discussion and a lot of the focus needs to be now, Eamon, especially in terms of the availability of vaccines. We're in a very, very good place at the moment in terms of most of our adult population has been vaccinated at this stage. So we're in a really good place in terms of the most vulnerable have been really well protected. But if you look at the wealthy nations, the average sort of vaccination in terms of the degree of vaccination is at least maybe 1.2 per head of population. So we've had probably 6-7 million for a population of about 5 million, you know, doses of vaccines.
Yes.
Whereas, so that's over 100%. But if you look at some of the poorer nations, some of these, their vaccination rates are 1-2%. And that is going to be an enormous problem because when we look at variants and where variants are likely to arise, variants will arise where the virus is replicating and it's transmitting at its highest level. And that is in those countries where you know, the vaccination availability is very, very low. But more importantly than that, Eamon, is that these people are essentially without protection. And for some of these countries, you haven't seen the consequences there yet, because the Delta variant hasn't hit some of those countries yet.
But it will.
But you could, it will. Inevitably, it will, Eamon. That's just the way these viruses, these variants spread. You could imagine, if you put your cast your mind back to last year, you could imagine if on a daily basis we were seeing maybe 1,500, 2,000 people being infected and confirmed cases here each day, our health system would have been overrun. Like for a prolonged basis of a number of months, our health system and the deaths would have been really, really high. We're essentially now accepting that in some countries where, you know, the vaccines are more limited, these people are prone, these vulnerable people, whether it be frontline healthcare workers, older people, you know, susceptible people, underlying conditions, that if they get the virus, they're going to die. And so I think there's a really important discussion, a really important ethical discussion now in terms of that we need to look at this from a global perspective, not only in terms of limiting the potential for variants to develop and those variants to come here, but purely on ethical grounds. And
yes.
Mike Ryan, very eloquently, and he always like such a good sort of communicator, he described this best in terms of when we begin to talk about booster programs.
Yes.
And the analogy that he gave was that here we have, we've got a life jacket, and each of us is looking for a second life jacket when there are so many others who've none.
Yes.
And I think that captures really well. So I think that that's the major risks there, major risks in terms of, from a global perspective, and even in a sense in terms of the equitable and a sense of fairness and sort of, yes. you know, an ethical approach to this, but even in terms that will serve us well indirectly. And I think that's some of the discussion that we'll focus now, especially around booster programs, the need for booster programs. I would certainly be in favor of booster programs under very selective conditions. I think some people now in the autumn, winter months, I think should get a booster. But for example, the approach that's been taken by Israel at the moment, where I think from the over 12s up, they're going to give everybody a booster. And I read reports there yesterday, I'm not sure in terms of its accuracy, but they're basically saying people who are doubly vaccinated now, they're being regarded as not being protected. That in my view is wrong. If you're doubly vaccinated, you may not be protected fully in terms of being protected from getting infected by the virus, but you've got really good protection against becoming very ill. And that is probably the best that vaccines are going to achieve for us. That is the best that most vaccines achieve. So I think that's going to be, so as you widen that lens out and look at a more global perspective, not only focusing on the US, but in terms of some of the policy and the intentions were good early on. So for example, we had this COVAX program and alliance,
yes.
which with the intention to make available, you know, an affordable and in a timely way, make vaccines available to the poorer income countries. But again, Eamon, that so far has only delivered maybe in 10% of the numbers yes. that it had hoped to achieve. And again, some of the high income countries really must have to look at themselves in terms of some of the policies they're pursuing. So not only are they competing, for example, with this COVAX problem in terms of buying vaccines and securing them in a timely manner, some of these countries are going now and actually buying them from the COVAX program and again denying access of the poorer nations yeah. to those vaccines. So there's a big discussion, but unfortunately, I mean, that discussion needs to take place pretty quickly, because when this virus and this variant and this Delta variant currently gets a hold, it can really spread through very, very rapidly. So I think it's really important questions there and discussions to be had.
And it's fair to say, is it not, finally, that we're in for a long war here rather than quick fixes. There are no quick fixes with when we take into account, through that wider lens, the point you make there about low vaccination rates in countries, in third world countries, but also in the United States of America.
Yeah, I think if you look at a parochial level, and if you look initially at Ireland, I think we're in a really good place. And I think I'd be very positive looking forward. And the reason why I say that is I don't think this virus is going to disappear. It's going to be with us. But the protection we have is the direct protection that each person has had because they've been vaccinated. And that's a really good protection. And that's going to protect us and really reduce the burden for us in terms of, you know, people becoming very seriously ill. But more broadly, if you look at this at a global level, we are relatively progressed from sort of this acute pandemic phase where it's moving there more towards becoming endemic. But there are many countries around the world that probably still haven't seen the worst of this, that still haven't really experienced this Delta variant transmission at very high levels. They are at really extremely high risk. There obviously are risks then associated with new variants arising. But again, I'm very hopeful there, because knowing how the immune, and we know from many years of research in terms of immunology, how the immune system works, I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see a variant that can totally evade the immune response. And the reason why I say that is because when we are exposed to the virus or vaccinated, we produce antibodies maybe against maybe a handful of different regions
yes.
of the vaccine, this protein that we produce. And some of the variants can evade that to a degree. But we've also got other types of immunity, these T cells that help with immunity, that recognize hundreds of different regions on that protein. It's going to be very difficult for variants to evade that. And that form of immunity is the immunity that protects us from getting very sick. So I'm very hopeful, Eamon, in that. And speaking as an immunologist, I think the power of the immune system And normally that immune system works because we're exposed to virus, we're exposed to bacteria, and we cheat a little bit by giving the vaccine, because we give a little bit of the virus. So it allows us to generate that memory, generate that immunity without having been exposed to the virus. But the power of immunity, you know, you hear reports of waning immunity. That waning immunity is to be expected. That's what happens. Antibodies wane over 5 or 6 months. We may be predisposed then or exposed more to greater risk of getting the virus. But importantly, if there's one message I would like to leave you with then, Eamon, is that, but we've this other memory part of our immune system that if you're exposed to the virus, you would trigger more of those antibodies. These T cells would be used to get rid of the virus and stop it getting to the stage where it causes damage and causes serious illness.
Okay, Professor Paul Moynagh, immunology professor from Maynooth University. We're very grateful to you for joining us on The Stand. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks to all of our listeners. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.